Good morning, Your Honor, Chief Justice, Justices, and please the Court. Your Honor, we are here based on a lower court ruling that we feel violated our client's Sixth Amendment rights to fair and choice of counsel. Specifically, we find three primary errors in the lower court's findings. First, I would state that the order of March 2nd, 2016, clearly the judge utilizes an appearance of impropriety as a factor. We believe that's an error. Number two, we find that we believe that it's an error in the court's finding that the plaintiff met the burden with regard to not only whether or not an attorney-client relationship existed, but also whether or not the matters at hand were substantially related and whether or not there was confidential information exchanged. The third factor, area we believe the judge erred is in finding that the plaintiff met his burden with regard to any of the information that was disclosed as being prejudicial or confidential. And that does kind of, and I'm going to talk, that does kind of flip up to my last point, but I think that they are intertwined. With regard to the first error, we believe that it's very clear case law reflects explicitly that the appearance of impropriety is not the basis for disqualification. It's an antiquated and Walmart v. Quorum, 251 Nebraska 805,
clearly states that appearance of impropriety is not the basis for disqualification. In fact, in that, they also note that it's the substantial relationship of the matters that is to be reviewed, not that appearance of impropriety. And so when we're looking at, moving on to the next issue we find, which is the meeting of the burden with regard to the attorney-client relationship first, there was no evidence presented here that indicated any express or implied assistance or advice on behalf of the attorney with regard to creating an attorney-client relationship. And Patterson v. Sworn, May, Smith, and Anderson indicates that it's the conduct of the parties and the attorney that should be taken into consider here, that what they're looking at is competent evidence of actions that were taken. Here, in that case, for instance, the client had filled out a questionnaire. They had paid the retainer amount. They had asked for representation. That doesn't exist here. The only evidence that was presented to the court was that Mr. Heckman had sought counsel, and when asked specifically on the record, who was your attorney at the time? I was looking to hire Mr. Reed.
I'm sorry to interrupt. But you're talking about the record, and I have a question about the record preparation.
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. The record preparation date in this case, according to the file, was May 31st of 2016, but the BOE in this case wasn't filed until after the briefing was complete. Is that significant?
Your Honor, we don't believe it's significant. One, because we believe that we addressed those issues in the reply brief, and thereby catching that error in time.
What do you mean, catching the error in time?
In our reply brief, we were able to indicate where we had erred in our citations. But I think I would also note that it's not just whether or not the Bill of Exceptions was there. If the pleadings, if Your Honors don't want to look at the brief and the arguments in the brief, they can look at the pleadings. And there's case law that has indicated that if there's an error in the citations or in the way that the brief has been presented, that the court can look at the face of the pleadings. And I believe that the face of the pleadings still supports the argument that no evidence was produced. There is nothing that's been produced by the plaintiff in this case indicating that confidential information was ever exchanged between
the parties. Weren't there two evidentiary hearings on this issue?
There were two evidentiary hearings on this matter.
Some evidence was offered at those evidentiary hearings.
Some evidence was offered.
That would be contained within the BOE, is that right?
Yes, Your Honor. And again, I believe, although we do apologize for our error, we do believe that we did address that error in the reply and were able to address all of the pertinent issues here. Again, with regard to...
Counsel, when was the preparation of the BOE requested? When was the press pay for preparation of the Bill of Exceptions filed?
Your Honor, I do not know off the top of my head. I do know that it was late.
So you're telling me that it was not filed simultaneously with the notice of appeal?
I cannot tell you off the top of my head. All I know is I know that the bill of exceptions was not cited properly in the original brief.
Was it filed properly and timely?
We believe that it was filed properly and timely.
Was there ever a motion made to extend the time for preparation of the bill of exceptions?
Your Honor, I would be guessing if I answered that. I don't know off the top of my head.
You didn't file such a motion.
Your Honor, I would be guessing if I answered that. I honestly have no idea, recollection of whether or not there was a motion to extend the time on that. So
should
I apologize.
We just rely on the record for that?
Your Honor, I would state yes, that you could rely on the record for that. I apologize. With regard to the third finding, or the attorney-client relationship, again, we don't believe sufficient evidence was presented that formed an attorney-client relationship. It is going beyond just saying that we formed a relationship. Again, it has to be actions. The second part of that is that the matters need to be substantially related. Here, the testimony is that there was a motion to transfer venue that he was looking to have somebody represent him with. That is all he states in his testimony. With regard to what's required of testimony, the court has clearly indicated in Jacob North Printing that the matters, the appearance of impropriety and that the conduct of the party, the conduct of the parties and that substantially related matter are important. When they're looking at that and the evidence that's required, In re Olson says that general assertions are insufficient, and that's what we have here. We have, I gave him confidential information and I don't approve of him using it. Now, that moves me on to, I think, the most important and glaring error here is that there are somewhat competing interests here when you look at the factual and legal issues at hand. The facts are that there was a motion to transfer venue and that he had sought counsel to represent him with regard to that. However, what is very important here is that third prong of privacy, of prejudice. That is lacking, even if the relationship was formed. Arguably, even if the matters were substantially related, what we would argue is that there was no prejudice here because there was never an existence of confidential information, and that is directly from the evidence of Mr. Heckman, the plaintiff, who states that he never retained Mr. Reed, that he was looking to retain Mr. Reed, and he states that who was in the room at the time but the defendant in this action. It is very clear that privacy is required when it comes to confidentiality. Blau v. U.S., Wolf v. U.S., and most importantly, Pereira v. U.S. cites Wigmore v. Evidence, where they say that substantially related matters involve the same transaction or dispute or the substantial risk of the release of confidential information that would prejudice that other party. So it's not just that there's confidential information exchanged or received by the attorney. It's that evidence or that confidential information is private, expected to be private, and therefore not public in order to be made public. Once that information has been made public, it is apparent in case law, and that is Pereira from 1954, that if there is, that it is essential to, I apologize, the key case in this is U.S. v. Cope, it is essential that the communication is confidential, that it's deemed confidential. And here the defendant did not, or did explicitly state that there was another person, specifically the defendant in this action. And so therefore there was never confidentiality, there was never any privacy. She could have taken that information to any attorney.
Who did the plaintiff consult? He consulted with David Reed regarding a domestic case with his former wife?
With his former wife? No, it was a former girlfriend. With regard to, she had a motion to transfer venue, I believe, at the time.
The court found it was undisputed that Heckman previously consulted with attorney David Reed regarding plaintiff's domestic case with Carol Heckman.
I don't know if they were married. If they were married.
Well, now, was David Reed the plaintiff's attorney?
Yes.
And David Reed now seeks to represent somebody in a dispute with Brian Heckman?
What occurred, Your Honor, is that Mr. Heckman has counsel. He had sought, counsel 3 years earlier on a different matter with regard to a motion to change venue with an ex-wife now, is what I understand. But that was 3 years prior, and it had to do with the motion. May I continue?
You may.
He had sought that advice 3 years earlier. He came into the counsel room with who is the defendant, in this case, Ms. Marchio, to discuss whether he could have representation with regard to the motion to transfer venue. Does that answer your question, Your Honor?
And you now think you can represent the opposing party to Mr. Heckman?
Yes, Your Honor, because number one, there was never a relationship formed. Number two, that the matters are not substantially related. And number three, most importantly, there was never privacy, never confidential information exchange. He released information, if at all, in the presence of her, the party in the action at hand. And so there was never privacy. And that is required, and case law is clear that it's required. And one of those prompts, you can represent the client, that isn't a substantially related matter, provided there's no prejudice that's created. But if confidential information is exchanged, if there's privacy, prejudice is automatic. That's what we would argue, and therefore we would ask the court to reverse and remand the decision of the court. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. Fowler, good morning to you.
Good morning, Chief Justice. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, my name is Julie Fowler. I'm the attorney for Brian Heckman, who's the plaintiff, the appellee. I would like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal, please. With no disrespect to opposing counsel, I mean, we're professionally friendly.
Just as a note, you don't get rebuttal on your side of the fence, so you may as well take the whole 10 minutes.
Oh, thank you, Your Honor. But we do have a difference of legal opinion here. I would object to Mr. Reed handling this appeal. He's a fact witness at the first evidentiary hearing.
Counsel, what's the basis for this being a final order?
I believe that under State Ex Rel Walmart v. Cordham and the Griffiths case, that because the substantial right that you have is choosing your attorney, that you do have a right to appeal, even though there's not a final order in this custody.
Well, State Ex Rel Walmart versus Cordham was not an appeal, was it? It was a mandamus action.
That's correct, Your Honor. I might be referring to Griffiths then.
I think you're relying on Griffiths.
Sorry, Your Honor. But we would object to Mr. Reed handling this appeal as he is a fact witness in the case, and I don't think he can act as both an attorney and a fact witness in the same case. I'd like to start with the procedural issue here.
Mr. Reed file the brief?
Mr. Reed, he filed...
did he sign the brief?
No, Jeremy Jorgensen did, who I believe is no longer with their firm.
I see.
what happened is Jeremy Jorgensen, on behalf of the appellant, filed the brief. Then the appellee filed the brief. And then they requested the bill of exceptions. I think we're creating a dangerous precedent here. If a party can take the strategy, we're not going to submit the bill of exceptions until after the other side does their brief, so that we have the advantage of having the bill of exceptions. What I'd ask this court to do is treat this as if, since there was no timely bill of exceptions filed, there was no motion to extend the due date for the bill of exceptions to be filed, that the court treat this as no bill of exceptions was filed. And under the case law that's cited in my brief, then you can just look at the transcript. And you can't look at evidence that's referred to in the transcript alone. So that's what I would ask the court here to do today. I'd ask the court to affirm the lower court's judgment, as the standard is clear error. There's no clear error by Judge Hall here. He sets forth the correct test from the Portman case and the Griffiths case. He had two evidentiary hearings. He applies the facts to law. He finds that he should be disqualified. So I'd ask the court to affirm for those reasons.
Both parties asked for attorney fees in connection with the proceedings over the disqualification. Is that right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And the court deferred ruling
on those requests.
Is that significant for purposes of appellate jurisdiction?
For purposes of appellate jurisdiction, I don't believe so at this time. The attorney fees is something that was asked for in the original complaint as well. At the time of trial, I think that's when the court's going to determine determine whether or not attorney fees will be ordered in this case. What happened is...
Do you believe the trial court applied the correct law on disqualification?
I believe so, Your Honor. I think the two big cases here are the cases that everybody's referring to, are the Griffiths case and the Cordon case. And it says, look whether legal advice was sought, legal advice, whether it was in their competence, the attorney's competence, and whether the legal advice was given. At evidentiary hearings, there was a dispute or a difference of facts of what Mr. Reed discussed with Mr. Heckman. Mr. Heckman said, yeah, we talked about the case, gave me legal advice about the modification and about the transfer. Mr. Reed tells the court that, oh, no, I don't talk about the specifics of a case when I do a counsel. I just talk about generalities.
Was there an attorney-client relationship established?
Yes, Your Honor. He gave the legal advice that was requested. And there was also not only that in-person consultation where Ms. Marquillo, who's now the defendant appellant in this action, but there was some type of continuation of the representation, as there was some type of follow-up emails.
Would the transcript reveal how many people were at that event, that consultation?
I believe so. I believe in the court's order, at least, states that no one is disputing that Ms. Marquillo was present. When the judge made the findings of fact, he doesn't include that with his order, which is part of the transcript.
So clarify for me, then, what is not disputed with or without the Bill of Exceptions? How many people were there?
For the actual consultation, no one's disputing that Ms. Marquillo was present at that consultation. If the Bill of Exceptions is read, you can see that there is some discussion about some type of follow-up communication as far as emails of whether Mr. Heckman is going to make the retainer payment to retain Mr. Reed for
the action.
So
who was the attorney and who was the client or clients, plural?
The attorney was Mr. Reed, and the client is Mr. Heckman. That's who was given legal advice regarding his case with his ex-wife, Carol Heckman.
And other people were present. That's your view of the undisputed evidence?
No one is disputing that Ms. Marquillo was present on that in-person conference.
And that can be divined from the transcript?
I believe it is in the judge's order.
Thank you.
And I want to point out one other thing. Is when you heard the other party's oral argument, they talk a lot about the attorney-client privilege, Well, that is a related issue, but that's not the test. The test is whether the attorney-client relationship was formed and then the matters are substantially related. Well, the matters are substantially related. The other side, after having the consultation and obtaining private info from Mr. Heckman about his relationship with his ex-wife, Ms. Heckman, then moves to depose Ms. Heckman as an adverse witness against Mr. Heckman in this custody action. And one of the main issues in a custody action is what type of father is Mr. Heckman? How is he a father to his other child? How is he a father here? So I think specifically because they have this private information, that's one of the reasons they are subpoenaing her as an adverse witness.
So the similarity between the two cases is what?
The similarity?
The first action in which Reed represented Mr. Heckman involved Mr. Heckman's wife or ex-wife. Now what's the relationship between Reed Heckman and the new case?
The relationship between Reed Heckman and the new case is they're deposing the mothers of his other children as adverse witnesses against him. That's why they deposed them, to have comments about Mr. Heckman as far as being a parent. So exactly what he had that private information on is what they're trying to use against him here to say that potentially he's a bad father, that he shouldn't have custody.
And that Reed somehow got that information while he was representing Mr. Heckman at the time. Involving Carol Heckman.
Right, because...
And then he's allegedly using that knowledge now to bring the action against or represent the action against Mr. Heckman.
Right. I mean, he has a duty to a former client, and now he wants to use that information and calls that person as an adverse witness against him.
Is that information private if Ms. Marchio was present during the consultation?
Well, I think that comes back to the test. Is the test isn't just whether attorney-client privilege is waived. The test is whether you represented and then whether the matters are substantially related. And if you do get into the Bill of Exceptions, it shows that it wasn't just that counsel, that there was some type of email follow-ups from there. And maybe there was phone calls, but the record shows at least there was some type of email follow-ups.
So you want us to look at the BOE then or not?
I would ask, that's an alternative argument. I would argue that it's not proper. I would ask for the matter to be affirmed. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you very much. I don't believe there's any time for rebuttal. No time for rebuttal. We will go to the next case of the day, which is McGill Restoration versus Lion Place Condominium Association. Mr. Maxwell, good morning to you.
Good morning, Your Honor, and Justices. May it please the Court. My name is Ben Maxwell, and I am here today on behalf of the